minute.
Is this a Netflix thing?
It's actually a podcast.
What the fuck's a podcast?
You know, it's kind of like a radio show.
What's all that?
Radio!
Yeah.
It's the 22nd of November. It is -7 degrees in Glasgow, and I am considering having a lem sip for recreational purposes. I hope you're all well and welcome to episode 23, season 4 of You Call That Radio's audio podcast. This is a really interesting episode today. I was on Facebook and I seen a really good page called Lost Glasgow. They share loads of cool pictures and stories from Glasgow's past, and they were promoting and writing up this band called The Tenementals. So I just seen this. This is all new to me. This is only about a week or two ago. I watched the video called The Owl of Minerva, and both the animations and the lyrics blew me away. Instantly loved it. So I sent The Tenementals a message, and David Archibald of The Tenementals responded and said he would love to come on the show. So it's a really interesting conversation. They've basically made an album, a concept album about Glasgow's radical past. And David's an interesting guy. He's a working class academic. So we talk about class issues in universities. We speak about the suffragette movement. We speak about Glasgow's anti-fascist movement, and just lots of interesting tales of Glasgow from the past. So hope you enjoy the show. There's actually an album launch on the 27th of November. If you're a patron, then send me a message if you'd like to go. I've got a few free tickets to give away for it. You can sign up at patreon.com/ You Call That Radio. We don't have any sponsors or any funding or any adverts during our shows. It's all powered independently by the patrons. So thank you to everyone who does already support the show. And we're having a wee Boxing Day, Christmas night out. So check your Patreon notifications for information on that one. And also, my band Gyro Babies is playing the Alabama 3 after party on Friday the 6th of December. Once again, send us a message if you would like a ticket. They're very limited and they will sell out quick still. And that's just a nice wee warm-up for ahead of our album launch, the Dreams Are Mental album launch, on March the 29th. But, you know, I said there'd be no adverts, and that's starting to sound like adverts. So that's it. No more adverts. We're going to talk about Glasgow's radical past with David Archibald of The Tenementals. And thank you to Mako, as always, for mixing and mastering the audio for you. Hope you enjoy the show. Bye.
You call that radio?
First of all, thanks for joining me. What is The Tenementals?
Well, firstly, thanks for the opportunity to come on, Mark, and talk about The Tenementals. So The Tenementals are a group of academics, artists and musicians that live in Glasgow. And at the minute, we've been recording a series of songs that recount a history of the city that we live in. And we say that we tell a radical history of a radical city, and we try and do it in a radical way. So we're interested in exploring fragments of a city through song. You can't really tell the totality of history in any form of history, in fact. But in 42 minutes or 9 tracks on a 12-inch album, it's limited what you can do. So you get fragments, but we hope that within those fragments of the first volume of the first volume of the series, we've called the album Glasgow A History, Volume 1 of 6. And a journalist asked me the other day, why is it called Volume 1 of 6? To which, of course, the only response is, because it's the first one of 6 and there's another 5 to come. Whether we get there remains to be seen. But we are interested in a history of the complexity of the city. It's not I belong to Glasgow. It's a bit more complex than that. And we're interested in dissidents and dissenters, because we think that they forcefully change the shape of history by standing up and saying, no, we don't want it to be like this. We think it could be better. And we think that by looking at moments in the past where people have attempted to foster positive change, then we nurture and look after those little moments, and we see what we can learn, and we try and popularize them and blast them into the future. So The Tenementals are interested in radical pasts, but we're more interested in radical futures.
Brilliant, man. How do you go around choosing? I think you've got, according to the what I've read and what I've heard, you've picked up on things like is people from Glasgow fighting against fascism. You've got suffrage, the early suffragettes movement, and also you've got things like Jimmy Reid as well. It's mad that you've actually got six planned. How did you pick your first ones? Are these in order of things that are of interest to you personally, or is it just the way that the music came out?
Just the way that it falls, I think. Like, art has to fall the way it falls, I suppose. So I think that there's, a lot of the... I mean, I teach at the university, but a lot of the content of the songs is things that have just happened to me. I write the lyrics. Me and Simon, the guitarist, kind of put the songs together. I write the lyrics, and then he comes round to my house with his guitar. He writes the chords, and maybe between us we put some kind of a melody together. Sometimes it takes a different form. But the lyrics I kind of write, and sometimes they might be things that I first encountered when I was a teenager or even earlier. But as a teenager, I was interested in the Spanish Civil War. I was involved in the Young Socialists, and I read all the books that I could about the Spanish Civil War. So when we were coming to write A History of Glasgow and thinking about songs about that, then, you know, the statue to the members of the International Brigades who left from Glasgow and never returned to fight in Spain in the years between 1936 and 1939, where they fought against a right-wing group of people who had staged a military coup against a democratically elected left-wing government. It seemed that we would that would be an interesting tale to tell, but we were also interested in some of the complexities of that. So the Spanish Civil War, like all civil wars, there's quite complex stuff going on there. And basically the song poses a question about whether we need to know the complex stuff because the fascists are coming back, and they absolutely are coming back, whether that's in Spain or elsewhere. So that for us was a kind of, one of the songs that that was one of the first songs that we wrote. But another one of the songs that you mentioned there talks about Jimmy Reid. And Jimmy Reid, who some people might know, was the leader of the, or he was the recognised leader, the unofficial leader of the occupation of the yards, the shipyards, which took place, the four main yards in the Clyde in 71. And the workers then, they didn't go on strike, but they occupied the yards and they had what they called a working. So for a period of months, the workers controlled the shipyards. Reid was a kind of giant at that time. He became a kind of world famous figure in the Glaswegian, the British labor movement. He was on Parkinson, the Saturday night main television chat show, and after that, he was elected by the students to be the rector of the University of Glasgow, and he made a magnificent speech in the main hall in the university, in Bute Hall, and the speech was titled Alienation. And he talks about, you know, different aspects of, he talks about the rat race and why he shouldn't be signed up to the rat race. So when Reid died a few years ago, he was eulogized as an absolute hero by many people. Just when I was 18, I took a different view about Jimmy Reid, because at that time it was the height of the British miners' strike, and I worked in Brown's. I was a shop steward in John Brown's, which had been one of made gas turbines when I worked in it, but it was previously one of the shipyards that had formed the working in 1971. And I had moved to the stewards committee that we should have a pound a week levy for the miners to support the miners who were involved in a year-long strike when they were trying to close the pits, not really for economic reasons, but they wanted to destroy the National Union of Mine Workers because it was the strongest union in Britain, and they realised that if they could destroy them, they could make severe inroads into the conditions of working people elsewhere. So that was an absolutely political strike. And so that was passed. And what was meant to happen then was that everybody in the union was to give a pound to their shop steward. And then I collected the money from the shop stewards. But what happened was anybody in the union that never paid, I had to go and visit them and persuade them to try and pay the pound a week levy. And the name I heard all the bloody time was Jimmy Reid said the miners are violent. Jimmy Reid said the miners should have had the ballot. Jimmy Reid said this. Jimmy Reid said that. And the problem for me at that point was the chips were down. Thatcher was having a severe conflict with the National Union of Mine Workers. And whether he agreed with everything that the National Union of Mine Workers leadership had done was neither here nor there. The battle, the battle lines were drawn and battle had commenced. So at that time, I never had a lot of time for Jimmy Reid at all. Of course, if it hadn't been Jimmy Reid, they would have said something else. But Reid at that time, in my view, was on the wrong side at the miners' strike. Now, of course, you take a life and its complexity and its totality. So the song doesn't have a go at it. It's not a song about Jimmy Reid and the miners' strike.
It's not a Jimmy Reid diss track.
No. But there is a little line in there. There's a little line in there called it wrong when it came to picket line beatings, which you absolutely did, because in 40 years later, there's evidence, about police orchestrated police violence against the miners rather than as Reid was lining up with a kind of right wing argument about the miners being violent. So, that's a kind of long story, but in that song, we sort of look at the kind of complexity of the complexity of people. And, don't have heroes, Don't expect that you should have someone that you can agree with on everything. People are complex. People make mistakes and try and be able to discern what's the positive and what's the negative from them. But we put that all in a kind of song that we think is also quite fun and entertaining. We sampled some of Reid's speech from the University of Glasgow's the speech he made
gave some incredible speeches.
Yeah, he was a fantastic orator, he's in the song, he's in the Tenementals momentarily. We're glad that he is, and we want to look at the positive things, but we're not ashamed or afraid to look at the things where things could have been better.
And with regards to you mentioned earlier on about the rise of fascism, how dangerous is it right now? How close are we to and just the rise of fascism coming back? Well, because obviously the reason I'm quite interested is because obviously you're coming from a historic background, and we are saying that if you don't know history repeats itself, and I would just like to hear your opinion on that.
Well, I mean, I was in Spain. I was in Spain last year or earlier this year, and I passed by a rally organised by Vox, which is really the party of the sons of the grandsons and the granddaughters of Francisco Franco's. He was the dictator. The right wing fascists won the Spanish Civil War, and they ruled Spain with an iron fist from 1936. To Franco's death in November 1975. And maybe after Franco had died, then people might have thought that his resurrection was not on the cards. And yet in a relatively short period of time, people in Spain are afraid. Yeah, they're afraid of what would be the consequences. I was in a meeting in the University of Madrid last year. And a man said that to me. He says, "I'm very afraid of what the future holds." So, are we in the same position that we were in Europe in the 1930s, where Hitler was elected in January 1933, Mussolini had been in power, Franco came to power through civil war? We're not in that position, I don't think. But I think we see in countries in Europe. in Germany, in Austria, in Spain, forces of the organized far right, which are, you know, which are significant, absolutely significant. And of course, we know history. One of the things history tells us is that when they take power, they absolutely quash democracy. That their opponents become the enemy within, and the enemy within has to be dealt with. And of course, some of these issues have arisen in the United States of America. I don't think Trump's depends on how you define it, but Trump's primary aim is personal accumulation. He's interested in filling his pockets.
And keeping himself out of the jail.
And keeping himself out of jail and surrounding himself with people who are also, I mean, it's some kind of, it was almost like a parody where he names the people who are, you know, chief executive officers of gas and oil to be the new environment secretaries, or people who are, you know, bodies are covered with tattoos which take the name from the Crusades. I mean, these are people of the extreme right, so they're interested in personal accumulation, interested in filling their pockets, keeping themselves out of prison, and they are all of an extreme right political persuasion, and I think that's incredibly worrying. And of course, at home as well, but by which I mean in Britain, then, you know, the growth of the far right here is something I don't think we've seen in my lifetime.
So you're sort of saying that you think that there's been far right tactics used, obviously, by turning people against each other, so there is far right rhetoric, but the people themselves don't seem that overly concerned about ideology, but more like self enrichment.
Well, I think the right have been better at the left than the left, very broadly, appealing to people's naked self interests. And you know, there's nothing wrong with developing programs which do appeal to people's self interests. And, you know, we'll see what happens in Britain. But, you know, but the new leader of the Labour Party, you know, he doesn't seem to me someone who's prioritised, the working class and of course, when racism and fascism emerges, it doesn't just emerge amongst the working class. It's a cross class phenomenon, and you get fascism at the upper echelons of the society amongst the upper class, amongst the middle class, and amongst the working class. But as someone who positions themselves politically on the left, then I'm interested in how you might mobilise working people to resist that. So, you know, so there's a concentration on policies that might be developed by working class people, by the trade unions, who historically have been the most effective people at preventing the growth of fascism, are the most prepared to put their bodies on the line, whether that be in Cable Street in East London in the 20s or in Europe and elsewhere, or the people from Glasgow, 30 and more, who went from Glasgow to fight in Spain and died and never put their bodies on the line in order to fight fascism there. So I'm interested in labour movement strategies and socialist strategies that might be discussed and put into place to counter the fascists.
Yeah, I think it's quite a worrying time, because it's weird. It's Starmer got in without... We're used to politicians lying and giving us false promises, false hope. But he seems like the Prime Minister that I can remember in my lifetime that didn't promise anything. He kind of just sort of said, yeah, it's going to be really bad. It's going to be tough. But I think the Tories were just so terrible over the various four or whatever Prime Ministers that they had, that people just needed a change. So it is concerning that you've got people at the Reform Party that will happily lie and offer something new, or something, in theory, something new that they're going to claim. So yeah, that is quite concerning. Nigel Farage for Prime Minister, could it be Nigel Farage 2028? And Elon Musk 2028. How does Elon Musk fit into all this? Is there with the rise? Obviously, right now it's the 19th of November. The last 4 days, about 20 million people have supposedly left Twitter to join Blue Sky. I don't actually believe that's going to be a long-term thing, but I've been wrong before. What do you make of all of that? Because what's quite interesting here is that you could have a thing where there's actually a left-wing bubble appearing somewhere else and a right-wing bubble on Twitter.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not an expert on social media. I mean, it would be good. I mean, Twitter, any casual user of Twitter over the last year will have seen an absolute degeneration in it. You open it up and scroll through it in the morning. Not your followers, but the people that are picked for you. And it's just carnage, absolute carnage. So if Twitter was to go under, then I don't think many people at this stage would shed tears for Twitter in its current state. Of course, what Twitter did for many people right at the beginning was it did form a space where people could have these digital interactions, and it provided a lot of joy for a lot of people. I mean, I don't know enough about Blue Sky. Tenementals have signed up to Blue Sky, but really just to sell our stuff and let people know what we're up to. But these communications platforms, I suppose, it's like anything. You can't rely on them being owned and controlled by billionaires and then expect them to do good things. They're interested in accumulation. So they're interested in accumulation and putting people in power who will allow them to do what they want to do, which is accumulate profit. So, you know, Blue Sky, I think, is owned by billionaires as well.
I think so. They're all owned by billionaires, and I think.
Yes. Oh.
It's, you know, We're all in faith. Well, you call that radio just around Blue Sky as well. So, I'm saying that for. But I think I've seen it before though. And just, I think that a lot of people that have spent years building their fan bases in Twitter, I think, you know, people that are actually deleting it, fair enough. But I don't think it will last for long. But yeah, you've got billionaires. You know who you're going to give your money to? People are on Facebook without an irony saying I've joined Blue Sky. I'm one of them. But you know. That's Facebook as well, which is which probably got us into this situation in the first place with some elections that set us up to where we are now. But getting back to history, just to sort of talk about that, the Glaswegians that are involved in Spain. What's the song called that's on the album about that? And yeah, could you just give us a little bit more information? Because maybe for some of our younger viewers, they may not be aware of the Franco background.
Okay, so we wrote a song called A Passion Flower's Lament, which is written from the perspective of the statue to a Basque politician, commonly known as La Passionaria. And she was a left-wing radical. She was a member of the Communist Party in Spain in the 1930s. And that monument is to the men from Glasgow who went to Spain and they fought in the International Brigades. And the International Brigades was an international collection between 30,000 and 40,000 strong of people who went to Spain to fight fascism, because at that period, Franco had been one of three generals who rebelled against who led a military rebellion against a democratically elected left-wing government. And so there was a civil war that took place in Spain between 1936, between generally progressive forces, people on the, you know, the left and the, you know, the centre, and then the kind of far right and the right and the military. But and so 65 men from Glasgow went and never returned. But also what happened at that time is that there was a revolution in Spain in 1936 as well. So in the northeast of Spain, primarily around Catalonia and just below Catalonia, when the workers were resisting the fascist attempt to overthrow the government, the workers took control of parts of Spain. So in Barcelona, the workers organized a revolution. The workers ran Barcelona. George Orwell, who wrote an interesting book called Homage to Catalonia, he describes being in Barcelona at that time, and he said it was the first time I had been in a city where the workers were in the saddle. So in Barcelona, everything came under the control of the workers' organizations, even the cinema. Cinema was collectivized, and the anarchists. Anarchism was a massive force in Spain in the 1930s. There was over 1 million people in the anarchist trade union, CNT. And so the northeast of Spain was revolutionary Spain. It was not just like, it was not there just a fight for democracy. People were there fighting for revolution. They wanted, the peasants wanted to own the land, the workers wanted to own and run the factories. So of course the landowners and the church and the majority of the official figures in the church and the army were, you know, hell bent on absolutely crushing that and crushing any form of democracy. Anybody who was labelled as a Democrat was just labelled as a Rojo, a Red, and many people were just taken when the fascists would come into a city. They would just round people up, imprison them, and then take them for a walk in the evening and shoot them and bury them in shallow graves. And actually, they undertook, when Franco won in 1939, they conducted what they called a limpieza, a cleansing. And that cleansing involved the physical eradication of their enemies. Right up until 1973, the last political prisoner in 1973, if I'm not mistaken, executed by a garrote, where these fuckers are medieval, and they're executed with a garrote, which is tightened up, and you get strangulated or strangled. So the song we wrote is, you know, is salutes every one of those, you know, every one of those men that went to fight. But also because Spain was involved in that revolutionary action as well, there was some people on the left who were in favour of the revolution, and there were some people who were saying, oh, we need to be a bit more cautious, and it's just a fight for democracy. So there was a conflict between those groups. And some people get caught in the crossfire of that. And one of the people that got caught in the crossfire of that was a student from the University of Glasgow called Bob Smiley, who was a member of what was called the Independent Labour Party. And the people in the Independent Labour Party, they travelled to Spain, but just because of the different intricacies of the organisations, they didn't fight with the international brigades. They fought with a kind of different group. And Bob Smiley got involved in some kind of conflict between the pro-revolutionary side and the side that were concentrating on fighting just for democracy. And he got arrested when he was trying to leave the country. And, you know, he was badly beaten, and he died in a prison cell in Valencia. No one knows for absolute certain, but it's at least possible that he died at the hand of his own, and the people who were ostensibly on his own side. He may have died of natural causes. That's there is not an absolute certain fact about that. But we dedicated the song to him because he's not one of the international brigades, so he's not really remembered in some way. So I suppose the Tenementals are interested in these histories. You know, we want people to find out more about what happened, but we're also interested in the little stories that are a little bit more complicated than the stuff that's a bit not less neat. And we're interested in the margins of the margins. So we're interested in the people that get sidelined even from the stories of the great heroes that went and fought in Spain. So that's a long answer, but Spain's complicated, but inspiring. And the thing about it is this, what for me anyway, the Jean-Paul Sartre says in relation to the Paris 1968, oh, he'd jump into another country. But in Paris 68, there was a massive revolt, again, led by the students. And there was a workers' general strike. And there was the possibility that, you know, there was at least the possibility that there was going to be some form of revolution in France in 68. And Sartre says something like, if it happened once, it can happen again. And I think that that's the same for revolutions elsewhere. You know, the reason that the Spanish ruling class are terrified of the idea of the story of the Spanish Revolution is because they know more than anybody else. They know more than anybody else. The ruling classes know more than anybody else. The revolutions can happen again, and they can happen when people least expect them. And that's what happened in Spain. No one was really expecting that to happen. No one was really expecting the massive revolt in Paris in 68 to happen. So things pop up when they're least expected. So we're interested in nurturing those little revolutionary moments and taking care of them, making them more popular, and blasting them into the future.
And what I think we're actually just now, just play. Thanks for that big answer. Why don't we play one of your tunes?
So my answers can be very long. I can keep
that's
it.
That's all right. I like it. It's not my special subject, so it's just good to hear what you've got to say about this stuff. And
I just say something about the music. Yeah. And so as I said, you know, I write the lyrics, and Simon is the guitarist, very talented musician. Simon also does the artwork for the Tenementals. We've created some artworks which we're happy with. We hope other people like them. And Simon and I work together on the little videos that we make. Not just us, but, you know, primarily us. And Simon, I think as well, that song, we kind of put it together in my house with a couple of lemonades. But Simon Simon used an old guitar that he found in the street. Simon lives in Govan. And he found this old Spanish guitar in the street. And so I think there's something quite nice about that, in the sense that what's nice about that, or what's the fitting about that, to use perhaps a better word, is that the Tenementals are also interested in using things that have been discarded and rubbished and put into the dustbin of history. And we're interested in recovering them and looking after them and seeing what we can do with them. So it was quite fitting that we found an old Spanish guitar and tried to make something that we thought was quite beautiful from it.
That's excellent. And just to clarify, you called it as a wild research project. Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
A wild research project. And also, I did hear you on another interview saying that, that as well as it's about how history books the beginning, I don't know what the example was you gave, but you were talking about history used to be taught by theatre back in the day. And yeah, if you'd like to just expand on that.
Okay, so you could say that history is too important to be left to the historians. That the Tenementals, by bringing out an album about which claims it's a history, and demands that it is taken seriously as a history, what it's doing, I think, one of the things it's doing is posing the question is, well, what is history? So if we regard the outputs that historians make, which is like standard essays, 8,000 word an essay, or a book, a history book, 80,000 words long, we're interested in saying, well, what would it be like if academic historians or academics produced histories in a different shape and in a different form? What would we gain from that? We might lose something, but we want other academics, we want historians to listen to the Tenementals album and say, okay, I'm going to assess that as a work of history. And we think that we hope that there's something to be gained by doing it differently, and maybe the example that I mentioned in another interview was the Haitian the story of the Haitian revolution by C.L.R. James, who kind of one of the key books about the seminal account of the slave revolt in Haiti is the Black Jacobins. And before it was produced as a history book, it was produced as a West End play. So that history book, that history comes into being in a different shape through art. So what we're interested in exploring, if history becomes art, what's gained, what's lost? And of course, you get different histories. Maybe the histories are more personal. maybe the histories are less rigorous. You know, there's no footnotes in the Tenementals album. There's no where you can go and check up their sources. But we hope that maybe there's something that you can gain. But it's up to other people to say, to call that. You know, we're not going to review our own album. We're happy for other people to engage with. We're also happy if people engage with it and they're critical of that. But that's fine. But we want to have that conversation.
And it was so basically the Tenementals is new to me up until a week or two ago. Shout outs to Lost Glasgow, a great page on Facebook who share some really interesting facts and photography from the city. And yeah, they just shared.
Can I just say, Lost Glasgow have been great supporters of the Tenementals and they've been really valuable. Right at the beginning, I asked Nori from Lost Glasgow. I said, can we join forces? I said, we've got 300 followers on Twitter and you've got 177,000 followers on Facebook, but maybe we could work together. So they've been, and Nori wrote a blisteringly great review of the album and on Lost Glasgow. So we're very grateful for their support. And Nori's actually comparing the album launch and Oran Moore on the 27th.
27th of November, and we'll be talking about the support act after the song as well. We've got a very special support act, which we'll get to. So this is The Owl of Minerva, and the animation's fantastic as well. It really just grabbed me.
Simon
did that as well. It's really fantastic. It really grabbed my attention. And the lyrics as well, just really, it demands your attention. So could you just give us a little bit of background to The Owl of Minerva and where this all comes from?
Yeah, sure. So there's a kind of phrase or an aphorism associated with the philosopher Hegel, which is the owl of Minerva takes flight at dusk. Now, different people will spend a lot of time interpreting that. One very simple way of thinking about it is just it begins, as night falls, we begin to understand things. We begin to understand things at the end of them. And I was walking along Minerva Street in Finiston, which is at the foot of the Finiston Crane. And I thought, maybe this is the way an artist might differ from a historian, maybe not. But I just thought, I wonder what it would be like if the owl in Minerva was on top of the Finiston Crane and lived there and flew over the city and talked about what she saw. And then and ask some questions about what history was, and that was the song. And once you know that, I mean, if you write songs, sometimes you might know it's like you think, well, that's the song. I now need to do it. But actually, 50% of the labor, in some way, is recognizing what the thing is. So that was how the song came into being, and then the same process we worked that soul together with a couple of lemonades and a few different sessions, and it's probably it's the first track on the first side of the first album, so I think that says something about where it sits in the Tenementals.
Let's give it a shot.
Finiston Crane, she flies east. Agricola's quota, the half-light, where the rapids of revolution give way to riverbanks of financialization. Mongo's children lie in slumber in ballrooms of pleasure and bars of ale, silent forges of production. Comes to settle on a red road in ruin. She ponders, what will rise from these broken bricks of utopia? New futures, new presents, or new pasts? And still the river flows. Western trance, she flies west. Colonial gardens, bourgeois baths, boulevards, great and western. Four-story, tenemental, sandstones red and blonde. Georgian terraces, parks of circus, Kelvin bridges. The three judges, stones of Arlington, stitched by Polish tailors in halls of Oriental residence. She comes to settle on a flagpole of learning. She ponders if the past is simply random, non-systematic motion. Why does it always settle into patterns of scarcity and depression? And still the river flows. The Earl of Minerva takes flight at dusk from the Finiston Crown. She flies south. Gorbals, teens, Glasgow greens, housing schemes expansive. Citizens from Bengal, Donegal dip bread in the ghost of Viking cauldrons. Long ships, long gone. But in the hour of the wolf, tramways transport thug dies to midsummer wakes on Cathkin Braes, where Joyce's donkey carnivals in Castlemount. She comes to settle on a golden dome of worship. She ponders what value the ragpicker who rakes through the dustbin of history, conjuring a constellation of possibility. And still the river flows. Takes flight at dusk from the Finiston Crown. She flies north. Hills of Hag, hills of Lamb, canals, Forth and Clyde. She surveys a slow motion majestic panorama, poor of coin but rich in gallus swagger. Beyond the black hills of Molendina, a gallery of preachers on a highway of historical time. Prodigion. Comedion. Bible John. Christ, even Pauper's John. She comes to settle home on her cantilevered roost. And she ponders. She ponders if the past is just one thing after another. Perhaps interruption is the true revolutionary act. And still the river flows.
So yeah, that's the Il Minerva, taken from the new Tenementals album, the Strophin in Oramore, on the 27th of November. And there is tickets available, and they are free, I understand.
Yeah, we got some funding from Glasgow City Heritage Trust, which paid for the production costs of the album and the costs of the Oramore gig. So that's amazing. We're very grateful to them. They, from their point of view, I think they see it as a way of raising a kind of awareness and understanding of the city's built environment, which is what they're interested in. So it's quite enlightened on their part, and it's good for us, and it's good for people who can come and see a free gig.
Yep, I've already got my tickets booked. I've put a link in the info for anybody who's wanting to order a ticket. It's limited to 2 per people. It's free, but book in advance because I believe it's almost sold out. And we've got some comments. We'll read a couple of time for a couple of the comments that are coming in. Dan Sun says, "What a journey of Glasgow! Brilliant words. Worried about Popper's John though." And Stuart's saying, "I wonder if that's the same Popper's John I remember."
It's everybody's Popper's John. I mean, that's a shout out to all the Popper's Johns everywhere.
We've got Dr. Normal saying, "Burn, great lyrics." I'm a bit of a midgy raker in history myself, says
excellent.
Effie Mew. I love the correlation and inspiration. And he also adds, "There's nothing but thanks for the research and dedication to humanity's true heroes and spotlighting their sacrifices for others' right to freedom of self and thoughts through the arts, music and poetry."
Absolutely, that's really nice to read these comments, that's lovely.
And Mark McInnes is saying, "Is that you in the Winter War?" I'm in the Winter War. That's just a wee bit of an inside joke, just because I like it when I'm not into this summer water, man. I like a nice cold tap. Okay. I don't have time. I'm a busy man, mate. I can't be in 10 seconds from my water to come off the tap. So, yes, this episode is sponsored by Winter Water.
Okay.
It's free from the tap.
If you free from the tap. That's what we like.
Brilliant video. The animation's fantastic. So, shouts to Simon for doing that. Let's have a wee look at it. So, it seems like the album's focusing on the radical history of not only Glasgow, but of course it's going to be Glasgow-centric. There's a big element of Glasgow. So can we talk about the history of Glasgow? Where did Glasgow come from?
Oh, that's for the album 3 or 4, maybe. We'll come to that in due course. I actually spent 30 years in Govan, so which was, you know, I lived in Govan for 30 years, so we might have another album dedicated to Govan. Because Govan, you know, Govan would have been bigger than Glasgow before the origins of the city. Glasgow's 850 years old next year, but Govan was the centre of the spirit. Govan was the spiritual centre of what was called the Kingdom of Strathclyde, which was, you know, I don't know how. I actually still think some of that history is kind of not that well known in the city, even although in the last few years, there's been more knowledge has come to pass about the Govan stones. There's a collection of medieval stones in the church in Govan, and there's a long story about that. But in something like 870, a group of Vikings and Gaels set sail from Dublin, and they laid siege to Dumbarton Rock for 4 months. They killed the king, and then they defeated. It was a kind of Brittonic kingdom, and they sailed up the Clyde. They formed a new settlement in Govan, and then they created a kind of, that became the centre, that became a new kingdom, Kingdom of Strathclyde, and Govan was the centre of it. And they created these kind of sculptures, these kind of possibly death stones, and they're there in the church, and it's quite an incredible history. And I think a lot of people think about Govan and they think about the shipyards. But there's a whole history, there's a whole prehistory of Govan, which is super interesting as well. And so, I mean, maybe further down the line, we'll write a little story about the history of Govan, or Govan might sneak in there as well.
So yeah, Govan. So Govan's album 4,
possibly
album 4. So it's what other topics on the new album we've got? Let's talk about Monica Queen, actually.
Yes, so, I mean, Monica Queen is an extraordinarily talented singer who, I think it's from Lanarkshire, I don't know if she's from Bells Hill or somewhere like that, but, our drummer, Bob Anderson, who also runs a little micro label that we bring our tracks on Strength in Numbers Records. Bob drums with Monica, and Monica's partner is Johnny Smiley, and Johnny Smiley mixes and masters the tracks on the album. And you know, we were in the luxurious position of being able to work with different talented female singers. And we had said to Monica, maybe that Monica would maybe record a track with us. And we hadn't got round to do that yet, but we were doing a concert in the St. Luke's in September 2023. And we asked Monica if she would maybe just do one song with us that night. And we sang a song, or we asked her if she would sing a song by Victor Jara. Victor Jara was a Chilean protest singer, artist, poet. And in 1973, in October, in September 1973, again, there was a democratically elected left-wing government that was overthrown by a military police, a combination of the military, basically, overthrew the democratically elected government, killed Pinochet, Pinochet was the leader of the generals. Salvador Allende was the president who died when the military bombed the presidential palace. And Victor Jara, who was the protest singer, was arrested in the immediate days after, in the immediate aftermath of that. He was taken to a football stadium, which was used as a concentration camp, where they broke his fingers and then in the next few days shot him dead and then dumped his body in the street. And 50 years to the day, plus one day after Victor Jara's body was discovered, we were doing this gig. So we thought, well, let's do a Victor Jara song, because while we remember the people who were killed, the artists, the poets, the singers, when we sing their songs, then in some way they still walk with us. So we asked Monica if she would do that. And she came in the night before with Simon and his little Spanish guitar. And we were in La Chunky, which is like Tenemetal's headquarters, which is owned by Ronan Breslin, co-owned by Ronan Breslin, who's the keyboard player in the band, very talented musician. And they just did it once. And I was like, wow, that was absolutely amazing. The first take was just like, that was phenomenal. And then the next night, so they rehearsed it two or three times, but they totally had it down. Monica does not speak Spanish, but we'd said to her, maybe you could speak, we could maybe do a new translation, or because it's always nice to do it something slightly different in some way. So we were maybe going to do a new translation, and she said, well, I don't speak Spanish, but I speak Italian, and I could maybe have a go. So she had a go, and it sounded good. So she sang it the next night. We did 9 or 10 songs, and then we went off stage, and we came back on, and we came back on as an encore, and I introduced, said a few words about Victor Jara, and then introduced Monica and Simon. And, it was a special moment. I mean, it was a special moment in that special moment for the Tenementals, but it was a special moment on the night. It was total silence.
Is it Monica's full band that's supporting at the at the album launch?
Yes, Monica, a partner, Johnny, plays the guitar and sings, but Monica's the main lead singer. And when Monica and Johnny play together, we have an acoustic set, they're called Tenement and Temple. But when they play with that kind of Monica and the big band, they've just given themselves a new name, if I'm not mistaken, which is Monica Queen and the Sorrowful Mysteries. So this will be the first public outing for Monica Queen and the Sorrowful Mysteries. And they'll be playing, half an hour, 35 minutes, something like that. And worthwhile going to see them and then get up the road and missing the Tenementals. I mean, they're fantastic in their own right.
Well, yeah, tickets. I've put the Eventbrite link there for them. They might check it. I've already got my tickets. So if anyone want to go along with me, then give me a shout. With regard, also, there's a lot of class, mentions to class throughout the album. And there's also something, there's been a bit of controversy this week about classism in, is it Edinburgh University, I think it is?
Yes.
Uh-huh. What's your experience of classism in the university setting?
Wow, good question. well, of course, I mean, wow, how long have you got?
Lee Rush.
I suppose I would say the universities are, I was born and, I was not born in a middle-class background, far from it. And I left school, worked in a factory and went to university when I was 28 or 29. And I had spent 10 years before that as a political activist working in trade unions for community organisations. Spent a year of my life trying to organise the campaign against the poll tax, which was good because Thatcher got a bloody nose in that period. And I went to university to read books when I was about 28 or 29. And I wasn't really sure what I was going to do. And I ended up getting a job there and I ended up teaching there. And universities, if you're from a working class environment, universities as a teacher, as a member of staff, they're awkward places because the rules of the game they're run on middle class mores. And it just takes a while to find your feet, by which I mean about 15 years, because it's quite difficult. It's a difficult thing to navigate and to negotiate. Working class people are often very vocal about what they think about things. And middle class people are, I don't want to make massive generalizations, and yet I just have, but, middle class manners are often about silence and listening to silences and hearing silences. Whereas if you make something where, if you do a thing and your working class pals don't like it, then they'll not be slow in telling you about it. So, that's a funny thing. I mean, I wouldn't be the only person that goes as a university worker. I work in the university. Comparison to some people, I get well paid for it. I'm no disputing that, but also I work. And increasingly, many people who work in the university sector work in extremely precarious working conditions. I mean, last week there was a report, and I think it was in Cambridge, which said that the majority of tutorials are taught by people who are on part-time contracts. So universities are not ivory towers. I don't know. I think my experience of teaching students from different classes, is that that's a positive one. I love teaching. And this year, I mean, one of the universities are amazing places. And one of the things which is an absolute privilege to do is to teach what are basically your own research interests. So I've been teaching this year a course called Radical Film and Television. So these are films that I think are of interest. They're films which center the focus on questions of revolution in Spain, the Spanish Civil War, revolution in Algeria. Today, this week we were looking at a Cuban film, which is a little bit critical of the Cuban Revolution. And that is, that's a real privilege to do that. And I suppose you're teaching, you're encountering students who come from all sorts of different backgrounds and different, not just different class backgrounds, but different geographies. There's increased numbers of international students in universities because of the intricacies of the university funding systems, and international students pay, well, let's say, exorbitant fees. That's one of the reasons why there's increased numbers of international students here. So it's class, of course, is the thing that you can't identify, you can't see, and it's also, a lot of the people who draw up, diversity agendas, some of them maybe used to be working class, but it's harder to deal with class, because let's face it, if the campaign against gender inequality is to abolish gender inequality, well, what's the campaign around class inequality? Is it to abolish class inequality? Well, I'll sign up for that, absolutely, because that's the abolition of the class system. But so, of course, people are against diverse. People are against. They're against. They don't want class. They want class to be addressed. But they don't want the abolition of the class system. And it's the one thing. It's the one thing that capitalism cannot, in my view, in my opinion, put that on the table for discussion. Anyway, it's the one thing that capital cannot negotiate with. They can't say, okay, You could have a capitalism that dealt with a different relationship of genders. You could absolutely have that. Of course, patriarchy and capitalism hardwired into each other as well. But class inequality is absolutely essential for the maintenance of the established order. I mean, you know, for the Trumps, for the Elon Musks, but also for the Starmers. You know, capitalism is dependent on the super exploitation of the proletariat. For some people, that sounds like super 19th century, but fundamentally still the case.
You said about the radical film thing that you're doing. Was it a module, sorry, you were doing for radical?
Yes, it's a 10-week, a 12-week course.
Is there any films from that you would recommend that maybe people could check out?
Absolutely. I mean, the Battle of Algiers is a fantastic film. Not just like interesting politically or historically, a phenomenally moving, dare I say, entertaining, you know, film directed by the Italian filmmaker Portocorvo, about the Algerian revolution against French occupation. The Battle of Chile is a three-part documentary about the events in Chile between 1970 and 1973. Absolutely gripping stuff. Really gripping stuff. Land and Freedom is a film about the Spanish Revolution, directed by Ken Loach. The director of the Battle of Chile, Patricio Guzman, made some other films afterwards. The Battle of Chile is a kind of direct cinema. It's a kind of, you know, it's a actuality footage of the events. He made some more poetic documentaries afterwards, all of which are outstanding. They are very valuable. I'm trying to think what else. We watched a film called Paris, La Commune, Paris 1871, which is a six-hour film about the Paris Commune, the First Workers' Revolution. And, you know, what was great was the students watched, not all of them, but a lot of them watched all of it, which was was fantastic. So that's a very interesting film. There's an amazing film called Burn, Quemada, which is also directed by Portocorvo, which is about revolution sort of, and it's like in a mythical place or a fictionalized place. It's actually not on the coast, but that's another great film about revolution. There's a few to be going on with.
Brilliant. That's a nice little list. I'll see if any of the capital streaming platforms will show them. Or I'm sure they're out there somewhere. But I've got a wee note of them, so I appreciate that. So we've got like time for maybe one more song. I've got the Peter Piker Pink lined up here. We can maybe to play us out. Just give us a wee bit of background for that. That'd be great.
Well, during the lockdown, I took a walk up to what's called the Martyrs Monument in Sighthill Cemetery. And it's a monument to the people who participated in what's called in different ways the 1820 Radical Wars or the Radical Rising or the Scottish Insurrection. And it lists the names of the people who were killed for their part in that, three people who were killed. And then it lists the people who were deported. And for me, most people in Glasgow don't know that much, or the central Scotland don't know that much about 1820 and the radical wars, that it doesn't sit into the public consciousness that much. And I saw this little, there was one of their names and it was listed and it said, his second name said Piker Pink. And I thought, that's quite interesting. They don't even know his name. And the lack of certainty around his name for me was a mirror, it connected with how people understand 1820. For some people, it was too radical. For some people, it was too nationalist. British spies were involved in it. It's all a bit complicated. So I thought, when I saw Piker Pink, I thought, that's the song. And then we asked Sarah Martin from Bell Sebastian to sing that with us. And so we were delighted that Sarah sang the lead vocal on that. And and that's the little song we made.
Brilliant stuff. Well, thank you very much, David. Been a pleasure speaking to you today, and I'm looking forward to that album launch. I'll put the link in the comments to the to order the album in Bandcamp, and of course to order the free tickets from Eventbrite to the show at Oran Mór.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. It's been a pleasure and a privilege speaking to you.
No worries, man.
Come and see the Gyro Babies. When is the date?
March the 29th.
March the 29th.
So that's our own Tenementals. We've got our album called Dreams Are Mental. Dreams Are Mental, Tenemental. And that's March the 29th. It's early. So you're welcome to join us at that one. But yeah, brilliant. Really interesting hearing this. And I'm really looking forward to listening, giving the album a proper listen. If you start to finish a few times over. Yeah, good stuff, David. This is Peter Piker Pink feature.
Peter Pike or Pink?